accession number 19667, Reel 2.
Johannes Lichthelm, Reel 2.
Right. So, when everything was dark and quiet enough, we left our bikes a little way away and went along the bicycle path on the right-hand side of the road where this ditch was. And very carefully, with a grapple iron, which we had made, found his machine gun, wrapped it in jute bags, and hung it along the bar of the bicycle. So we walked away very quietly, of course. None of the Germans had heard anything, which was lucky. We were bloody lucky. And approached roughly the road at Rijswijk, which goes to The Hague, which has a bridge. And just after the bridge, on the road to the right, to my home, Voorburg, the villa, the first villa, within about 100 yards on the right-hand side, was for German officers, had been requisitioned for German officers. We didn't expect anything until suddenly a light was shown by a soldier on us, and only thing I could think of was, in German, of course, "God, didn't see you. Good thing you shown the light, because otherwise we might have just gone, and hit you with our bag." And he let us go. So that was a near escape. And another time later on, was just the right thing to say in German. And, as long as you say something, you get away with it. But otherwise, it's fatal, of course. Isn't it?
What date approximately was this?
That was at the end, possibly in the autumn of 1940. So within a few months. I don't know where the other machine gun came from. I forgot really where we picked that one up. And we picked up near this same place, this bridge, and this villa where the Germans were. There had been a load of boxes with ammunition being dropped in the canal. How are we going to get that? Well, one of us of the organization knew the water board. And the water board people always had a special cap when they were doing something. So we borrowed a little flat-bottomed boat from the water board. We borrowed that one. We had our caps. And we just, sort of made it look as if we were taking mud out of the fleet, which was the canal. And all we stood on the outside, on the left-hand side, so that the higher side of the boat would sort of shield what we were doing. And we had an enormous amount of ammunition from there for guns, for machine guns, and goodness knows what.
Who had dumped the ammunition?
Soldiers who were guarding the aerodrome. And of course, the other gun was the one that somehow they got hold of, probably, from parachutists. The German machine gun was the one that we had to pick out from the ditch. So also probably dumped there when they probably had different officers who were a little bit more active and said, chuck the damn stuff away, boys, instead of handing it in to the Germans, you see. Anyway, I got home, and everything all right. So, I mean, all our pools are very low, and the water level is pretty high. Sometimes just about a foot, 2 foot deep, and you have already water. So I made a concrete box, which I sealed as well as possible. But and I put the machine gun in there, which was in the belonging to the farmer next door. But then later on, I had a look, and luckily the cows hadn't gone through the lid of it, but the whole thing was full of water, so we had to find a different place. And we found that in the cemetery, because the cemetery was much higher than the rest of the country, of the, you know, Vorburg. And so that was arranged, and we took a whole night to, of course, during the night you couldn't move, really, because there was a curfew. So I had to move in tin, which we soldered, which I soldered, this machine gun, and the other one as well, and we moved it to the cemetery in daytime. And at nighttime, we stayed the whole night, we stayed in the cemetery, and dug a hole where we had been told that would be safe, and lined it with timber, and lined it with, and made a roof before we put all the soil back again. But what happened to that, I've never heard. Whether it was when there was a traitor, or somebody who had been stupid and talking too much. We never knew. We suspected somebody. And of course, then suddenly, one day, that must have been near enough the beginning of 1941. Yes, the beginning of 1941. I went to my friend, the sergeant, one afternoon. And there starts the worst story of my life. There was no car, no vehicle from the Germans there. That left it around the corner. And I put my bike against his window, his wall. And he came storming out and shouted, John the Gestapo. And he was a good runner. He was a very fast runner, at 100 and 200 meters, etc. And he ran away around the corner. So I very quietly picked up my bike and went away, trying to trace where he had gone. And these two Germans passed me, or so I thought they were German, but they weren't, we found out later on. One was, I don't know who the second one was. The first one was the champion runner on the 100 and 200 meters. I forget his name now. In Holland. And he was an NSB'er. And he'd gone into the Gestapo. And around the corner, in the main road, was this Überfallwagen, which is a sort of a Jeep type, on which at least 6 to 7 soldiers have seats. And I've seen those things in Germany before the war, where I had some experience how they used to work. And I found my friend well away. He had run across the railway, the streetcar rail, and over it, the jumps, the hedges, and the other one had followed him. And they were hundreds and hundreds of yards away when I heard some shots. So I found them, and they were on the way back walking. And I was behind them, and I was just going to make up my mind, now how can I let him know that I'm going to attack this traitor, this fellow. I didn't know who it was, I thought it was German. And I was going to run with my bike between his legs, of course, and then have a very good chance of knocking him, getting him down, or probably already down, and mastering him. And I took too long. They must have walked about 50 yards or more And people were standing outside the houses wondering what the shooting had been like. And then, about a few hundred yards around the corner, came the second man. And he was also shooting off with his pistol or gun, whatever. And I left it. And that's the worst story.
Where did this take place?
In Vorburg.
You keep mentioning this organization. What exactly was it?
It was no, didn't have a name or whatever. But we just had a group of men who all felt the same as we did, that we had to start, you know, preparing. Nobody knew how long the war would last. But at least, you know, do something. Because the Germans were getting worse and worse and worse.
Were they all ex-servicemen?
Yes. Yes, all ex-servicemen.
So young men?
Yes. We were anything from, well, my brother was about 17 or 18. 17 he was then. And I was one of the older ones. But most of us were around 24, 25, etc.
And how many losses did you have? How many casualties?
I'll come to that in a minute, one who went back home. We straight away, I went home myself. And they were just having their meal. And my father's home, that was, because I lived somewhere else. And I told my brother, I said, get ready, and told my father that we would go to a certain address, which had all been arranged. It was a friend who I knew from the corn exchange and the business. And he had a factory in Overschie, not very far from Rotterdam, where they extracted oil from rape seed oil, all sorts of oils, from vegetable oils. And he had connections with an organization, Vrij Nederland, which is Free Netherlands, which issued papers to, you know, all the people who were interested and wanted to hear what was going on. And of course, everything was mentioned there.
What and kind of papers? You mean news sheets?
A new sheet, you know, sort of. And we had arranged this, if he ever got in a pickle, he would come to us. And if we were in a pickle, anything happened, we could come to him. So, rushing home, my father quickly gave us some money. We picked up one or two things. I didn't go to my own home, because I didn't know where they would go next, you know, which would be the next point of trying to catch some of us. My sister and others went to others of the, or you know, the ones who were in our group, to tell them to get away and where we were going, which is a bit dangerous, of course, you know, because you know the message that the Gestapo got, you know, some people would probably give it away. After torture, etc. And so we went both on our bikes to Overschie, where he lived, just outside Rotterdam, outside of Rotterdam. And we must have been about five or six of us. And I remember Lau Wezepoel, who hadn't been married all that long, after a few days, living a few farms away in a Dutch hay barn, where they kept on feeding us, etc. And where we could go at the farm, we could go to the toilet, etc., etc. He wanted to go home. I said, don't go home. It's too dangerous. Yes, but I said, well, anyway, go somewhere else first to an acquaintance you can trust and let them find out whether the Germans are watching. And he went back. And after the war, of course, he was still alive, but only just. He had gone, and they were sent him to a Vernichtungslager, which is, can you give it a right name in English?
A camp, of course.
A camp where they, you know, sort of try to make you do so much and so little food that you die. And he was one out of nine. One from nine who survived, and the other 81 all died during the period. Then at the new intake, he was sent to Auschwitz, and he survived the war there. But they all suffered from hunger, edem, which is, you know, they start to swell up, etc. And they had to feed them with specially prepared food, which the Americans had, and probably the British had. They had to save them with that. And I don't know how many years after that he lived, but he couldn't have become very old, I wouldn't think so. Because I didn't hear too much of stories after the war, because I was back here in England, you see, I'd settled here. And I know my friend von Strate, the sergeant. The story is that the SS filled up a ship in Kiel, the German port, with prisoners, took them into the
Baltic,
took me into the Baltic and blew them up, put the charges on, tied them all down and blew the ship up with all the prisoners. And that was already the day of or the day after the Germans surrendered. But we never knew for certain, but that was a reasoning about what had happened and where they had sent him, etc. And we think that's what happened to him. Yeah. Anyway, so my brother and I stayed there for a few more days, and my friend had arranged, I started to grow a mustache, and he had arranged a pair of glasses. You know, not the flat ones like you sometimes see in a film, because it comes out, doesn't it? But slightly for eyes which are very slightly out. And I had some sort of camouflage, of course. And then we were sent through his organization to farms in the east of the country, fairly near to the German border. And we lived on farms there for a certain period, until my father had found, through family, a route to Switzerland. And we found that one in 41. Is it 40? Yeah. I think that was still in 41. We went to these farms and stayed there for months and months, sometimes only a few weeks at one farm, then move over to the next farm. So there must have been a very good organization there from Vrij Nederland. And well, at one time I was going to see my brother. I was on a platform in Zwolle, changing trains. And some Marseille, which is a country police, Netherlands police, for the whole of the country, semi-military, and some four or five Marseillais were walking on the same platform, and one turned around, had a look at me, and I just kept on walking, you know, as if I was waiting for the train, which I was, of course. And then he turned around until I came to the next family, and a friend of the family was a girl whose father was a policeman. And as soon as I arrived there, she said to her friend, "Do you know he's being sought by the police? He has committed fraud." So she said, "Don't worry, he's being sought by the Gestapo." Oh, right. Then I knew why this Marseillais must have recognized me and looked at me and turned around and walked with the others away. Of course, the Marseillais was 100%, I would think. The Marseillais, for instance, when I came to the UK, when I arrived here in England and I was called by the Queen Wilhelmina, she was protected by Marseillais that had escaped with her on a torpedo boat from the British, you see, and on the first day of the war. Yeah. So they were okay. Anyway, so eventually we had to come back to Voorburg, and from there we were told how to go. We had to go to village Putten, which is near the Belgian German and Belgian border. And from Putten, there were a family, father, mother, and a daughter, and possibly a son, yes. And the daughter was home. And she took us one morning over the border and on the train to Antwerp, where we had to go to an address of the consul. We were there one night or two, no, various nights we must have been there, because we had to go to Brussels to get identity cards for Belgium and this side of the demarcation line. And we were given an address in Brussels and had our false papers there, so that we would be able to go to France on the other side of the demarcation line and from there to Switzerland. And yes, yeah. So as soon as everything was arranged, it was worked out that we would leave for Switzerland. And we went through by train, everything by train, to the Namen or Namur in Belgium, to the border, the demarcation line. And it was just about getting on for 12 o'clock when a Feldwebel, that's a sergeant, came in and asked for the identity cards. We were with two others, I haven't mentioned it yet. It was a couple. He was a Vaandrig, and that is a professional, he wants to become a professional officer, and a Vaandrig before they become officer. And he was married to this lady who was the daughter of a general in the Dutch East Indies, and they had to go out. And they thought, well, we better have these two strong fellows to help them over the mountain, you see, which was really just as well for them. And when we came to that demarcation line, this Feldwebel came in and said, "Guten Montite." I said, "What shall we say?" In German, of course. "What shall we say? Good evening or good morning?" You know. And he disappeared, which was just as well, because my French address in Brussels was not too damn good. you know, I kept on studying and studying, but I didn't think I was going to be too good at it. My brother had spoken and studied more French than I had, of course, and studied any French tongue. So it didn't come into my category, really. Anyway, then he disappeared, and we had no more trouble. We went through various towns, and we had to go to a town very close to the border. And somewhere we left and went by bus to this town, not very far from the Jura. And we were waited for by a guide who would take us so far through the road, through the woods, near enough where he could tell us where we had to go onto the mountain and over the border. The last town we had been was Besançon. But I think this other place could have been, Montbéliard. And that's where he met us, and we went to his flat, and he said, "You got to have different, you can't go with those shoes. Those boots of your brother, they're all right, but you got to have some other boots." Well, we had French money with us, which had all been arranged, of course, through my father and through the Belgian people. And I bought some old-type ski boots from him. He said, "That's right, you can buy those. And now you, because you're going to be in the snow." Well, sure enough, it was snow, right? Anyway, we came outside that village when we met two German soldiers. Well, one was a corporal and the other one was an ordinary soldier. And they halted us. He had already noticed this and he had stayed behind, you know, which he told us he would do, of course, because they might get to know him in the long run otherwise. And I said, "Where are you going?" I said, "We are going to a village and we want to do some skiing." Yeah. "Oh, all right." "Oh," said the Feldwebel, the corporal, he said, "In that village, if you go to Frau so-and-so," said, "they got the equipment there, you can hire the equipment, you know." And I said, "All right, let's just write down, what is the name?" And I wrote it down in my little notebook, you know. And he said which road that we had to go to. So, and then they left us. So then our guide disappeared. And he had already told us how far we had to go until we came to a little bridge. And once over the bridge, we had to climb up the mountain, the Jura Mountain. But it wasn't very long before we suddenly heard the tracks of a vehicle on the road. So they must have reported that they saw us, the four of us. And I'm sure he must have been in bloody good trouble, this German corporal,